Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Paul Nolan. Paul is co-MD at the Hoffman Agency and COO at CC Group PR. He is an experienced company director who has worked most of his career providing public relations and communications consultancy to the global telecommunications industry. Despite his mother thinking he could become a doctor, Paul knew he was more of a creative than a scientist. After a work experience placement at Burson Marsteller while he was at university, Paul followed up with a PR course which kick-started his career. Paul has led the CC Group PR agency since 2012 after he and his business partner Richard Fogg completed a management buyout. And earlier this year, CC Group was acquired by the Hoffman Agency, making Paul and Richard co-MDs of the combined entity. Paul, who received an ADHD diagnosis at the age of 42, alongside his entire family, says that being open and sharing about neurodiversity is the best thing to do. He says, the only way we're really going to overcome the stigma that surrounds it is to educate people on how many people it affects. I think more people like me actually create that comfort by talking about their own experiences to legitimize it even more. Paul Nolan, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Thank you.
It's lovely to have you with us. It's an amazing story that you and your whole family got an ADHD diagnosis at more or less the same time. How did that happen, and how did you personally receive the news of your own diagnosis?
It's a story that so many other families can relate to. It wasn't that I felt that there was something missing or that there was something wrong with me. It all started because we were struggling with the behaviour of our youngest son, Luke, who at the time was 5 years old, four, nearly five, and he became increasingly difficult to parent. He was had a serious issue trying to regulate his own emotions, which is a well-known symptom of ADHD. But it was the last kind of throw of the dice as far as where we were as parents at that time. We tried literally everything, include behavioural therapists, expert nannies in terms of how best to parent children. Spoke to teachers, all sorts. And, it was causing real toxicity in the house because we were literally at our wit's end, not knowing how we could actually help this clearly confused little boy. And it was a suggestion after the kind of desperation was starting to take its toll by somebody else that we might want to get him assessed for ADHD. We did. And upon the initial meeting, the psychiatrist we saw diagnosed him within about 15 seconds because it was that obvious to him. And at the time it came as massive relief because we finally had an answer we'd been looking for.
And then what were the next steps after that?
When we went through the process of trying to identify, what Luke's issues were, you're encouraged to do a fairly kind of comprehensive assessment, which means filling out all manner of questions, getting the thoughts and opinions of everybody in his closest circle, which obviously included myself and my wife as his parents, but also included grandparents, included teachers, included anybody that had been a close observer to Luke growing up. And going through the questions, being educated on the symptoms, looking at those behaviours, it became increasingly obvious to myself and my wife as we were going through that there were an awful lot of similarities between, how Luke processes information and how we did ourselves, including, the reactions that he was experiencing. Looking through all of those things from an adult lens makes you realise that, although the symptoms are, less exaggerated as you get older, they're still there and you can still see them if you look hard enough for them. So, one diagnosis in Luke soon precipitated my wife being diagnosed, then me, and then when 3 out of 4 of us were all diagnosed, we thought the chances of our eldest son also needing some help was quite likely. So we got him assessed too, and lo and behold, he got a positive diagnosis too. That was, 2 years ago, and we're now in the kind of aftermath trying to find a way to work through what is a fairly kind of passionate and chaotic household.
And what was the before and after for you personally in terms of your own diagnosis?
It came as a, I wouldn't say it came as a relief. It was useful to have an explanation to so many things that I did and some behaviours that other people couldn't necessarily understand or relate to. I think everybody's different, right? And ADHD is not a disability, it's just a point of difference. And it's a spectrum, just like a lot of neurodivergence. And people have stronger symptoms than others. And I always say to people that if you function perfectly well within your day-to-day, with ADHD, then there's no real reason for any kind of intervention because you can just continue literally living your best life. But if, on the other hand, you have a number of different obstacles in your life that you're struggling with that are exacerbating a lot of these symptoms, then it's more than likely you're going to need help of some description, even if it's, talking to somebody or it's medication itself. The more you know, the more you understand, and the more you are at peace with, why you do things. And you can also put measures in place to try and mitigate some of the extreme symptoms that you might have been experiencing at any given time. So it was an explanation, and it also gave me a kind of a framework to start making different choices as far as what I did as a person and how I approach work and what I could do to literally be the best version of myself.
And at the time, you and Richard were sharing the leadership of your business. Was there a kind of a before and after, before your diagnosis and after, in terms of how you led your teams or your awareness of how you led your teams?
Definitely came as a big boost to me personally. And I think it was because it wasn't necessarily anything to do with work itself, but everybody has at their limits as far as how much emotion they can reasonably manage at any given time. And at that point in time, managing a business was just one of my areas of focus. Parenting a difficult child was another, trying to be some sort of husband to my wife too. All of these challenges and areas of focus, each had pressure points. We were going through, anybody that runs a PR agency will understand the pressures that go with it. I mean, it's the same true of any business, I'm sure. I wouldn't know because I've only managed a PR agency. But it's a stressful game, right? It is high pressure, it's unpredictable, and you really have to be extremely resilient and just to navigate, uncertain working conditions. And then when you're dealing with toxicity at home, you don't get any respite from that pressure cooker, and the anxiety within you builds further and further because you literally have no time to hit the release valve. And that in itself puts pressure on all kinds of relationships, not just at work, but at home too. And that's where I was at that time. I went through a very, very difficult period, particularly around lockdown, when all of that was intensified, being stuck at home and, struggling to have, additional points of connection outside the family unit. And that was also where Luke, really, really struggled too. So that was a tough time. And I think we all found out quite a lot about ourselves at that time too. Being able to, understand the reasons why and talk to professionals at that time was literally life-changing. And I think being able to understand what the triggers are means that I've been better prepared to avoid those triggers, you know, coming again. I've understood the importance of things that most people take for granted, like the need for decent rest and recuperation, you know, the need to, you know, decompress a cluttered mind just by having, you know, moments of time to invest in your own well-being, to actually think about what your own mind needs to function effectively. And that, you know, leads to thoughts about proper nutrition and, you know, the need for exercise and the impact of dopamine in terms of feel-good factor. You know, these are all true of everyone, but, you know, they are especially true for neurodivergent people.
Yeah, so that gave you a path to understanding, which then led you to make changes, which I guess also helps to make you a better leader.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything that makes you a better person or makes you feel like a better version of yourself obviously transcends everything that you do in your life, including how you manage a business, how you manage your relationships, how you, you know, manage your own marriage, how you manage parenthood, you know, everything. And it does, the less cluttered, you know, your mind is, the more present you are more often, you know. And I think being present is obviously extremely important when you're trying to encourage positive behaviors in others, whether you're a parent or whether you're a director of a business.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's switch a bit to leadership. Now, you and Richard know each other very well. You're a very close and well-knit team. How does co-leading the business work for the two of you?
Well, it's something that we've had to work on. I think that anybody that knows us knows that we work better as a pair than we do individually. And that's because our personalities are completely and utterly complementary. I struggle at the things that Rich excels at, and vice versa. And it's kind of worked ever since we started, you know, working together 20 or so years ago. We were given an opportunity to run a small part of a business back in 2004 or 2005. And, you know, just working together for a short time, we started to realize that we were a powerful combination. And the more we worked together, the more we enjoyed it, the more successful we became, and the more we achieved. So it's always been something that I've always cherished and been grateful for, that our paths just kind of aligned when they did.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous. I do sometimes see co-founders and, you know, people who work together in that way. And I think it can be so positive and creative and beneficial when you complement each other so well. How do you describe your own leadership style?
I think that, and obviously you've got to kind of investigate the different styles of leadership, because if you ask anybody that question, it's not immediately obvious until you kind of read the different definitions. But I'm certainly participative. I'm certainly believe in collaboration, and I think one of my strongest, some of my biggest areas of strength is empathy in general. I'm very, very people focused and always have been. And, you know, I think I've always been passionate about building the best possible relationships with the people I work around as I can, which means understanding not necessarily how effective they are when it comes to tasks, but, you know, what drives them emotionally, what gets them excited, what makes them engaged, you know, motivation, and what their ambitions are, what they dream of, and, you know, what really kind of makes them feel successful. Because different people are driven in different ways and have different ideas of what success is. And it's a very subjective thing. And if you don't understand, you know, the mindset of an individual, you can't possibly be in a position to develop them effectively. I don't think that that's true of every leader I've worked with in the past. I think that, you know, I think there are very, very clear definitions about what a job entails, right? And everybody has a clear idea of, you know, success is about adhering to everything written on a job description. Whereas I've always felt that development can be shown in lots and lots of different ways that aren't, and they're not necessarily all listed, you know, in those documents. But that doesn't mean to say that somebody can't progress or can't be incredibly good at what they do in their own way.
But it takes a lot of empathy as a leader to be able to recognize what's going to make the individual people on your team really shine.
Exactly. But when you're in a business that, you know, that is its people, quite literally. I mean, we don't have a consumer brand. You know, we don't make anything. We don't license anything. Our business is our people, and our ability to do a great job depends on, you know, a very, very positive, ambitious, entrepreneurial mindset, you know, across the team. And therefore, you need to, you know, kind of understand how you're going to get that from an individual at any point in time. And it's the same is true whether or not they're straight out of university or whether they've been in the business for 20 years. A lot of, you know, the human mind works in very, very similar ways, regardless of age. And the more you understand about how an individual processes their emotions, the more effective you can be as a leader and a manager.
Yeah, I love that. Now, Paul, you were one of my interviewees for We Need New Leaders. And in our interview, you said that helping other leaders manage colleagues who are neurodiverse is a big part of what you do. How does that play out?
Well, I think that this is something that I'm trying to learn more about. As I said, I'm 2 years in, and because of, you know, the challenges we've had with Luke, I've read an awful lot of books, spoken to a whole lot of, you know, different psychiatrists, including, you know, the people that have helped me. I know it's a bit of a running joke, but it really does take one to know one, right? And you can absolutely identify traits in other people that you experience within yourselves. I mean, you also drive people mad going around diagnosing everybody all the time, and you have to be a little bit careful what you say to some people sometimes, because it gets a little bit tired. But as I said to you before, that most businesses and most hierarchies and most job descriptions are built on, you know, trying to find and develop all-rounders. And in PR, it's for a very, very basic and obvious reason. The more an individual can do successfully, you know, the more billable that person becomes, the less need you have for supplementary help in other people, the more profitable a business becomes. And therefore, you know, the more you can achieve with fewer people, the better the business, right? It's just basic commercial business rules. Unfortunately, you know, there aren't many people like that. I honestly don't think there are any people like that. And I think you will always be able to find areas of weakness in anybody if you look hard enough. But there are definitely things that people excel at more than others. And anyone knows that a successful PR agency, in fact, a successful business, any kind of business, is built based on building confidence, you know, within individuals. And you build confidence in individuals by pointing them at things that you know they're going to do well, that you know they're going to enjoy, the things that you know are going to motivate them to want to do the best job they absolutely can. As people develop their careers, it becomes increasingly obvious what those areas of strength are. And you set out with the best will in the world to kind of identify whether or not, you know, you've got an all-rounder, or whether or not you've got somebody that's geared up for a particular specialism or whatever. And then I think that once you've found that spark within people, once you know how they think, and once you know, you know, what gets them excited, you're then in a position to know how you're going to retain that person by trying to harness all of that excitement and all of that spirit as best you can for as long as you can. And that's why I think, you know, effective management and leadership ultimately is. It's about creating an environment where people can bring their absolute best selves to work every single day to try and wear a smile for as long as is possible. And let's face it, that isn't possible every day in a PR agency, because there are frustrations at every turn. But if you're there to empathize in those situations and explain that it's just part and parcel of the job, and explain that it's just human nature to react to certain things in certain ways, and you normalize reactions to those types of things, then you build resilience, and then and the resilience then protects the confidence, because they realize that it's not something that an individual is doing wrong. It's just the fact that what we do can often be very, very difficult. That's how I've approached management over the last 10 years or so, ever since I've actually been mindful of how I've managed a team and what the leadership traits I actually have and the things I look for in others.
Yeah, neurodiversity is only one form of diversity. And I know that the CC Group has consistently achieved the blueprint diversity mark for attracting, retaining and nurturing diverse talent. And you mentioned in our interview that the PR industry is notoriously non-representative. What are you doing now at the CC Group and also the Hoffman Agency to ensure that you welcome all groups?
So we are very proudly blueprinted by an organisation called BME PR Pros. Now, that is a organisation that was founded by one lady, Elizabeth Bananuka, and she has been very, very passionate about trying to promote racial diversity across the PR industry, not just agencies, but in-house as well. And she developed this passion through effectively how she was treated as a black woman in public relations, you know, a number of years ago. She faced, you know, a lot of prejudice. She was acutely aware of how little, as you said, how little representation there were of the BME community across the industry. And she wanted to do something about it. And this isn't something about it as far as spelling out what diversity means and then just giving every single agency to tick a box and just fly the flag of tokenism. This was much more about what are the, you know, ingrained agency processes you adhere to? Who are the different suppliers you work with? What's your approach to recruitment? What's your approach to suppliers? How do you make sure that you are being as inclusive as you can be across every different aspect of the business? And it really is a drains up kind of interrogation of how a business thinks, how it acts, and how it really demonstrates on a consistent basis that it wants true representation across its workforce. And there are a number of different learnings and a number of things that, you know, the BME PR Pros, you know, community look for. But they don't just want a flash in the pan. They just don't. They don't just want a PR agency to earn their badge and then disappear and like and not continue any of the positive changes they have made. They want a complete kind of cultural transformation, because that's the only way you can affect change on a meaningful basis, you know, for the longer term. So we started talking to Elizabeth, and we were desperate to achieve blueprint status, you know, ever since we understood what the blueprint set out to achieve. And they have a number of different stages. It starts with an ally status, which is, you know, you're trying really hard, you're doing all the right things, you just need to keep it up, and we'll keep an eye out, and, you know, as long as you're committed to this and you improve in these certain areas, we'll give you full status. And then when you're lucky enough to be awarded full status, it lasts 2 years, then you have to reapply, and then you go again. And there's lots of different elements to the BME PR Pros community as a whole. I mean, they run events. They have a fantastic mentoring program called The Exec, which is there to give, you know, real advice and help to leaders of the future that want to really kind of, you know, make meaningful progress in the industry. They have awards that celebrate, you know, positive progress of individuals and agencies in general. And the blueprint is, like I said, it's the kind of the quality mark that really does give an agency something to be proud of as far as its long-term commitment to diversity and inclusion within, you know, within the industry. And we've now been awarded that twice, which we're, as I said, fiercely proud of. So I think 4 years. We've just recently been re-blueprinted in the last few months, and I think we've got another 2 years to run, and we're certainly going to be doing all we can, not to just kind of maintain all the positive progress we've made, but we've got a very willing acquirer in the Hoffman Agency from a UK perspective that are keen to follow suit, and they will be, you know, adhering to everything that we've started, and they're absolutely committed to going with us on the same journey and to doing all of the great things that we've been doing as a business too.
I think it's a wonderful process because it's truly not superficial. It is genuinely transformative, as you say.
Absolutely. I think tokenism is one of the things that upsets Elizabeth the most. And you can, if you hear some of the experiences that she's been part of and some of the stories that she's heard from other members of, you know, the BME PR Pros movement in terms of the prejudice that a lot of, you know, people have faced over such a long period of time, you'd understand why it gets them so, you know, so incandescent with rage.
Yeah. One of my recent interviewees was Advita Patel, and Advita is the first person of colour to be chairperson of the Chartered Institute of PR in the UK. And she introduced me to the idea of bringing in a question of privilege into this discussion with all my interviewees, because she talked about her own privilege in terms of having an incredibly supportive family and community. So while she had not had necessarily always had a great time at work, she felt privileged by the support that she had from her family, which many individuals don't necessarily have. So on that note, how would you talk about your own privilege?
Well, actually, going through the process with BME PR Pros actually helped me be more comfortable with talking about it. I mean, as part of the whole process, you receive all manner of different training programs where you literally, you know, hear the stories of prejudice, and you look at the impact of white supremacy and white privilege, and you look at to what degree, you know, the agency, you know, structure, the whole business is actually was initially kind of formed on the basis of white privilege, like so many other businesses around the world. And you do have to be quite introspective, and you actually have to be honest with yourself. I mean, I definitely had to be honest with myself and confess to being a privileged white male that has, you know, benefited from the same system that served to oppress so many others. And that's quite an admission to make, but it's also quite, there's no stronger kind of catalyst to want to kind of do something about it at the same time. And it definitely gave me and so many others within the business so much more determination to actually affect that change. And you also have to be conscious of the fact that you are not going to achieve an entire revolution overnight either, right? I mean, there's so much work to be done. There is such an incredibly massive like imbalance at the moment. There is so much inequality rife still across the industry, across all industries, let's be honest. And if you know that you are consistently trying your best to try and, you know, give as many opportunities to as many people from as many different backgrounds as possible, then, and you're determined to maintain that and to keep it going for as long as possible, every single entrant, every single opportunity you provide to a member of the BME community, you're actually trying to affect change in a small way. And the more people that are given the opportunity, the more people have experience that they can then to use to market themselves, you know, within the industry, into other positions, other agencies, in-house, whatever, you're giving them a start that so many people struggle to get. You know, PR is a difficult industry to get into anyway. And the more opportunities you give to more people, the more you're giving them the chance to be successful in the future, as well as doing your best to try and develop them as best you can.
I love that self-awareness, Paul. Thank you very much for sharing that. So the business you're in, the Hoffman Agency and the CC Group, are both organizations with a stellar reputation. How do you think about your own reputation?
I think about it far too much, if I'm honest, as most, I think certainly most neurodivergent people do. I think that how I'm seen and how I'm viewed, it dominates my thoughts most days. And I think this is true with most people with ADHD. As I said to you before, you know, most people want to be known and celebrated for their strengths. And sometimes you can only be clear on your strengths if you're also transparent and honest about your weaknesses as well. And I think that people, as I said before, are most energized when they're focused in their areas of strength. And a lot of the time, the neurotypical expectation that's placed on anybody is just impossible to meet anyway. And too many businesses are preoccupied with this kind of all-rounded excellence, as I said before. So I think that the issue with neurodivergent people is that the weaknesses, if you're being viewed and you're being assessed by a third party, right, and they are focusing on, and they say, look, you do so many things so well, 80% of what you do is absolutely brilliant, but 20% needs an awful lot of work, right? I think neurodivergent people in particular will over rotate on that 20% over and over and over again. One of the common traits of ADHD is rejection sensitivity, and you know, any kind of criticism can hit you like a bus. You know, even if it's meant as constructively as possible, to be told that you're wrong or doing something wrong, you know, will hit a neurodivergent person extremely hard, and they will question themselves. They'll start to, you know, feel shame, all kinds of things. And a lot of people overcompensate trying to avoid that from happening, right? So it's why you often see people like running to exhaustion a lot of the time and actually working ridiculous hours, like wanting to people please in the most incredible way. It's because they are desperate to get that acceptance, to get that acknowledgement that you know what you're doing, that you're good at what you do. And that has a massive impact on an individual in terms of the fatigue that it builds within a mind. And then the more fatigue you try and sustain, the more burnt out you feel. And the more you then start to unravel, and then it becomes this kind of negative cycle. So the reputation and being seen in the best way possible is everything to a neurodivergent person, particularly a neurodivergent leader. Unless you're kind of aware of the over-rotation, and the supreme amount of additional effort that most will make. If I'm fortunate that I've got other people that keep an eye on me and know when I'm doing it, and therefore can actually help rein somebody back in, it's something that I'm always needing to be aware of or to be made aware of.
And how do you put it into practice? Not over rotating on the 20% or the 10 or the 5%.
Well, I, in all honesty, Shana, I don't a lot of the time. I rely on some incredible colleagues to pick up a change in emotion, a change in a feeling. When you're known for being quite a bubbly person that likes to crack jokes and have fun, when you start to go quiet and when you start to be a little bit more introverted, it's at different moments when you don't really react to things as you would ordinarily react to. 9 times out of 10 is because you're experiencing some sort of mental flood, right? Because there are literally far too many things going around in your head at the same time. And it takes the people that know you best, that really kind of understand how you feel, to know that something is wrong. But it's not just about being aware of it. It's then being able to extract the cause in a gentle way, and just to try and coerce and encourage conversation and encourage admission if needed. And I'm very lucky that I've got people like that around me, and I've had people like that around me for 20 years. And so I'm grateful that some of my colleagues have worked with me for such a long period of time, because they've literally helped keep me going at so many different times. And you get that too if you invest in your own mental health, which I do, in terms of discussions with coaches and mentors and therapists when required. I think that it's important. I think most people invest in their physical health every single day through gym memberships and whatever, and I don't see why people shouldn't do exactly the same with their mental health, because it requires exactly the same amount of management and upkeep.
Yeah, I really love that, that physical health and mental health require the same amount of upkeep, so that we are resilient and not oversensitive in the workplace to the slings and arrows that come, no matter how well we perform, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. But sometimes you just need somebody to, also a part of that, you need people to tell you that you're wrong and you just go leap into the wrong conclusions, that you're being over emotional. Sometimes you just need to hear that too, because we all do it, right? It's nothing to be ashamed of, although most neurodivergent people will feel the shame before they feel anything at all. It's just part of developing. It's part of learning. It's part of being a better manager, leader, better person.
Absolutely. Now, Paul, through the interview for We Need New Leaders that my passion is, how do we build the next generation? How do we resist old archetypes of leadership? And what do you think we can do, both collectively and as individuals, to change the old leadership archetype and encourage new forms of leadership to come through?
I think, going back to what I said before, it's about being honest and admitting strengths and weaknesses. It's about, understanding that not one person can do everything. And it's about spending and investing that time to build a strength in a person and not hammer them for their weakness, and actually try your best and try everything to keep confidence as high as it can be, because praise can go an awful long way, and it doesn't have to be reserved for the most incredible achievements. It can be the most basic success. And I think that a lot of that is trying to understand how we all think as individuals and unraveling all of the kind of subconscious bias that drive the decision making that within any kind of business, because it's there It is, and I think we all do it, and we all kind of make similar mistakes, and it's about taking a step back and understanding whether or not you're being fully balanced and reasonable and fair in the decisions that you're taking. And I think that stigma is a problem, and not just for neurodivergence either. I think there's some very, very kind of lazy thinking out there. I've always believed that diverse and inclusive workforces make businesses thrive just because they are more representative. If you haven't got decent representation in your business, then there is something wrong with the decision making that the leadership is taking in that organization. Any person would reasonably expect to find representations of their own backgrounds in any business. How else are they going to know that they've got an opportunity to thrive there if there's not? And everybody needs to be given the freedom to be themselves 100% throughout the day in any organization they work in. And if they haven't got that freedom, it's because that there is a prejudice or some archaic thinking or perception that's preventing that from happening. That is not a fault of the individual. That is a fault of the people that are governing that organization and deserving who deserves to work there or not. Businesses need to start asking themselves searching questions as to why they are not developing people from diverse backgrounds, why they're not attracting them, why they're not retaining them. Because they are all, if you're failing to do that, then there are systemic failures in the business that you're just choosing to ignore.
It's a very strong answer. Thank you so much. Paul, we'll now get to the three standard questions that I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
Unsurprisingly, it's an ADHD self-help book, because that's all I've been reading recently. It's called ADHD is Awesome, and it's by Kim and Penn Holderness, who I understand are big kind of web celebrities in the United States for varying different reasons. But it's one of the... Every book is useful, right? But there aren't many books that really do kind of strike a chord. Yeah, they have to kind of get you emotionally for you to really not want to put it down. And I read this book that talked about the struggles, you know, with ADHD in a family environment, and it was like, you know, turning a mirror on our own family so often, and it was great, and it made me feel better about myself having read it.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that listeners are going to love that recommendation. In terms of encouraging a new generation of emerging leaders, those who are coming from different types of diversities, diverse backgrounds, diverse identities, neurodiversity, what would be your three tips for them to land, keep, or create their dream leadership roles?
I think it's important to be true to yourself. You need to be able to express who you are, how you think, what you do. As I said, if you're in the wrong environment and don't feel that you can do that, then that's their fault, not yours. And I think you need to know and believe that that's important and not compromise on it. Because if you do compromise, then you are only bringing a part of yourself to any role and to any organization, which means that you're not giving the full strength that you could be bringing. I think that being self-aware is important as well. I think that if you understand the value that your own diverse background brings to organization, then you can actually help bring your own perspective, and you can actually use it to benefit how you lead yourself. Because these things are always done when they're symbiotic, right? It's not just about responding to a leadership. It's about trying to place an importance on your own style on an organization too. And then I think part of that is making sure that you are living and breathing all of the rules that surround effective inclusion yourself as well, which means, you know, surround yourself with colleagues from all kinds of other backgrounds so you can learn from them. And you are being as open-minded as you can possibly be, that, you know, there are different ways of tackling problems, and that the more perspectives you have, the richer an organization is, because especially in PR or advertising, right? The main focus for most of these brands is to be able to relate to the mass market. And if you are representative of that mass market within your own organization, then you're going to have all the ingredients you need to be successful. It's not just about, you know, the white kids with the very, very expensive educations that are going to have that kind of open thinking. Just be open to new ways.
I love that, Paul. Thank you. And last question, what brings you joy?
I thought about this. It's connection, human connection. Having spoken to my coach who I love dearly, she always tells me that one of my inner values is love, and that anything that actually encourages and makes you kind of feel that you've really had an impact on somebody else, you made them smile, you made them laugh, just to reciprocate those moments is what brings me most joy. Which is probably explains my people-focused approach to management as well.
Well, that's such a lovely answer. Paul Nolan, thank you for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.